Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hello, I'm Tess Vigeland. Employment numbers came out on Friday. Payrolls are up, but so is the unemployment rate. Still, one industry is definitely hiring.
It's going to be facing a retirement tsunami of extraordinary proportion.
That's Max Steer with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Max says there could be thousands of job openings in this industry.
It's going to be facing a retirement tsunami of extraordinary proportion.
So what job sector has gone begging? Is it A, the U.S. military? A tough war has led to missed recruitment goals. Or is it B, the finance industry? Hedge fund managers make so much dough they retire young. Or are we talking about C, the federal government? It's so strapped for workers, Uncle Sam will forgive your student loan debt as a bonus. Only one choice is true, and you'll find out which on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Imagine working for a company that employs 2.7 million people. That would make it one of the largest employers in the world. It's the federal government, and it wants you. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
This week's jobs report wasn't exactly grim, but it certainly wasn't good news either. Employers added 110,000 jobs to the payrolls, but the unemployment rate still rose to 4.7%, the highest level in more than a year. But there is one part of the job market that is healthy and growing. Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us Uncle Sam is on a hiring binge.
What little kid wants to grow up to be a bureaucrat?
I help protect the American people and the environment by inspecting nuclear power plants.
That is very impressive. Where do you work?
I work for the United States government.
This is a real TV ad for the Federal Civil Service. The feds have a pretty low budget for recruiting ads, despite a looming hiring crisis.
Join us. Make an impact.
For years, federal agencies have struggled when it comes to recruiting. As recently as 2001, roughly two-thirds of the graduates from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government ended up taking jobs in the private sector.
Our students want to serve. They come because they believe in something larger than themselves.
David Elwood is the dean of Harvard's Kennedy School.
When you look at the students that leave the Kennedy School with no debt whatsoever, 90 to 95% of them, of our two-year students, end up going into the public sector or the nonprofit sector. Those who leave with $90,000 in debt, 45% go there.
In 1999, when Marlon Paz graduated from an Ivy League law school, he thought about going to work for the Securities and Exchange Commission for about 1 second.
Private practice was offering me three times the amount of money.
The choice was simple because Paz was saddled with debt. Harvard's David Elwood.
If the federal government, frankly any government, really want to get high-quality people, they're going to have to find a way to help with the cost of education.
And recently, it has. A law signed about 10 days ago will forgive 100% of any federal employees' student loans if they stay in government for 10 years and make their minimum payments on time. Some federal agencies will pay off $10,000 of student debt per employee each year. And today, Marlon Paz is a senior attorney at the SEC.
Professionally, the benefits are amazing.
The SEC's paid Paz to get an advanced degree from Georgetown, and as for paying for his student loans...
I'm actually almost done.
In the last decade, many federal agencies have made a huge effort to compete for talent, offering loan forgiveness and other perks that are hard to come by, and for good reason. Linda Springer is the director of the Office of Personnel Management.
The federal workforce is approaching 2 million people. Roughly 60% of that workforce will be eligible to retire in the 10-year period that we have just now entered. Two-thirds traditionally will leave when they're first eligible.
That means in the next 10 years, the Federal Civil Service could need to hire almost 800,000 people.
It's going to be facing a retirement tsunami of extraordinary proportion.
Max Steer is the CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, which encourages people to consider government careers. He says the hiring process can still be slow and bureaucratic, But right now, there are very few places anywhere offering the same range of benefits.
If you're an older American and you decide you want an Encore career, if you actually come into federal service and work for 5 years and retire out of government, you have health care for life.
But the government's biggest selling point, according to Steer, can be the work. Federal employees are charged with protecting kids from toxins, keeping the country safe from economic Armageddon, and prosecuting environmental polluters. Steer says they can still be effective even through the changing politics of vastly different administrations.
Most of the jobs that are in the federal government really don't involve politically charged or sensitive issues. And even where they do, frankly, we need people who are, you know, career folks that are very talented, who are willing to be in there to make sure government is running right.
Sure, you won't get fabulously rich, but where else can you go to work and get a shot at saving the world? Assuming you can figure out how to properly fill out the requisite forms. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
This week we learned New York City Mayor and multi-billionaire Michael Bloomberg can add another title to his name, identity theft victim. Two men tried to cash $430,000 worth of forged checks with his honor's name on them. The battle continues against a crime that, according to the Gartner Group, claims one victim every 2 seconds. A new weapon is on the way from the credit reporting agencies, the ability to freeze your credit at will. Our friend Liz Pulliam-Weston is here, and Liz, is this going to make a difference?
I think it's a pretty big deal, actually, because at this point, 39 of the states in the District of Columbia have passed laws allowing their residents, or at least some of their residents, to have a credit freeze. And what that basically means is you have to have a PIN number to get access to your credit report. That's going to prevent basically most lenders from opening up new accounts in your name. It really is a great tool against identity theft, much more powerful than the fraud alerts that people had before. But you had those 11 states that were left out in the cold, and also in many of the states, only identity theft victims could get access to a credit freeze. So with the three bureaus saying, hey, we're going to do this independently and everybody can have access to it, at least that's the way it looks like it's going to be, you know, at this point, that means that everybody in the country can have access to this really effective tool for shutting down identity theft.
Let's explain again the difference between putting a fraud alert on your credit report and actually putting a freeze on it. What's the difference?
The fraud alert has been around for a long time. It basically is a signal to lenders that you think there might be a problem with your credit or somebody trying to access your credit. So the lenders are supposed to take proactive steps to make sure that you're the one applying for the credit. Now, in the past, lenders have sometimes never seen these alerts. They might order only a credit score and never see the flag. Now they're required to get this flag, but what reasonable steps they're required to take is still kind of up in the air. So it's never been a tight or foolproof way to prevent identity theft.
And it's also been something where you had to re-up on that every
exactly.
3 years, right?
Yeah.
Because I've had to do that myself. It's a pain if you don't remember.
Exactly. And also, consumer advocates have said that although the credit bureaus are supposed to share this information, that a lot of times they weren't. So you'd have to go to all three bureaus and re-up it, which was, you know, also a pain.
Okay. And a freeze?
A freeze basically shuts down access to your credit. You have to open up your credit to allow somebody to look at it in most cases, or a new lender to come in. So it's like slamming the doors.
Any downsides? Right off the bat, I think, well, what if I go to buy a car and I completely forget that I've got this freeze on my credit report and I say, yeah, sure, see if you can get me a loan. And they come back and say, no, we can't.
You put your finger on it. The biggest hassle is if you forget that it's there and you try to go apply for credit. And at this point, there are no like national requirements for how quickly the freeze has to be lifted. Usually it can be done in a few days, but it's not an instantaneous thing. And also, it doesn't completely prevent identity theft. If the lender doesn't look at your credit report or get a credit score before granting credit, then, you know, they're never going to see the fact that they can't see your credit, you know.
Right.
So it could still wind up being a factor, although I think that's fairly rare that lenders would extend credit without getting some kind of a look at your credit background.
Sure.
And also, if you're thinking that this will shut down anybody looking at your credit report, that's not true. Your current lenders can still go in there and take a look. You still may be approved for or on marketing lists where they send out those pre-approved offers. So it doesn't completely shut off your credit, but it does make it harder for an identity thief to open new accounts in your name.
Liz Blaine Weston is a personal finance columnist with MSN Money. Thanks so much for coming in.
Anytime.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Surprise! We've got another housing story for you this week. Yet more bad news if you're trying to offload your home. The National Association of Realtors says pending sales of existing homes fell 6.5% from July to August. The numbers aren't much better for builders of new homes, but perhaps you smell an opportunity there. And as a buyer, you would be right. Elizabeth Razzi literally wrote the book on home buying and selling. What kinds of bargains can you squeeze out of builders these days?
Tens of thousands of dollars worth of upgrades, especially for expensive homes. Things like upgraded kitchen countertops and appliances, lots of closing cost help, the kind of stuff that most buyers want but have to pay extra for when they're closing on a new home.
Is it true that home builders have more incentive to give you incentives than current homeowner does, because a homeowner maybe can wait a little longer and the builder just simply has to get that inventory off his or her hands?
Well, it depends. I mean, builders, they're dealing with very expensive situations. They have to get out from under these houses. Now, individual home sellers, some of them can wait out the market until it stabilizes itself. But if that individual home seller really needs to get rid of that home, they could be every bit as motivated to get rid of that house as the new home builder.
What kinds of things can you ask for from a homeowner?
Closing cost help is a great big one. Other things they can do is pay 1 or 2 years of homeowners association dues.
That's if you have a condo?
It's a condo, or most new homes these days are part of a homeowners association. And there are monthly dues. That money goes to pay for that.
By all accounts, this housing crisis is just going to get worse. Is it advisable, if you're thinking about buying a house, to hold off just a little longer?
Well, for one thing, it's not worse everywhere. There are some markets in the country, there are not many of them, where the market is actually not doing so badly. And even in the Washington, D.C. market where I am, there are some communities close into the city that are doing okay. But the thing to watch for, if there's a lot of unsold new house inventory in that market, your price is not going to appreciate for a long time. You're going to have to wait for all those builders to get rid of all those already built houses before the market turns back up for you. So if you do plan to move into one of those communities, plan to stay there for a good long while.
Elizabeth Razzi is the author of The Fearless Home Buyer as well as The Fearless Home Seller. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Our own Chris Farrell is limbering up and getting hydrated for another speed round. He'll answer 5 of your most asked questions in 5 minutes. And you think your clients are hard to deal with? Try spending a day in the work life of a school photographer. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Computers, phones, lipstick holders. It's getting hard to find a gizmo these days that doesn't have a camera in it. So parents can and do document every second of their child's existence. Yet one picture still holds a special place in our scrapbooks and on our mantles, the school photo, embarrassing as it may later be. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we head to an elementary school to meet the man behind the camera.
Okay, everyone, stand, the one that's standing, stand up nice and tall, hands at your sides, kids in the front row looking here. On the count of three, we're going to say spaghetti. One, two, three, spaghetti! Eyes at me, eyes at the camera.
Thank you.
My name is Sterling Hoffman. My company is called Sterling Portraits, LLC. We create portraits of families and children on location and school photography.
Okay, I'll do it. Pretty cool, huh? Okay, one more time. Great smile. Okay, you're next.
The worst scenario is to have, say, 2-year-olds or 3-year-olds, and one of them starts crying because they're scared, and then it snowballs and mushrooms, and next thing you know, you have a whole classroom full of children. They're crying. Whereas if you have them all laughing and giggling, even the shyest of a child will come out of their shell.
Hey there, Silly Willy.
Hey there, Silly Willy. Oh, did you call me Silly Willy?
I'm not a Silly Willy. Chin up a little bit. Right there. That's the winner.
These images that we're creating now are going to, they're timeless. They're family heirlooms. It's family history. And 30, 40, 50, maybe even 100 years from now, people are going to be looking at these images and they're going to say, you know, there's Granddaddy Willie, you know, the turn of the century.
Hey, you want to see a magic trick? What's this? Stand up there, I'll show you another trick.
Our total company revenue, including the school photography and our portrait art business, is around $1 million a year. Now, that's gross sales. That's not money in my pocket, obviously. A well-run photography business can look to make about 20% profit. It can vary anywhere from about $150,000 to $300,000 a year, depending on whether it's a good year or a slow year.
Okay, let me sweep that nose.
This is the guy who refused to do it at the beginning. Now he can't wait to get up there.
Say, Silly Willy. Thank you, buddy.
I mean, you can say something as simple as looking at the little 4-year-old right when you're ready to take the photograph and say, hey, say hey, turkey. And they'll say, hey, turkey. And I was like, you call me a turkey? You can't call me a turkey. And meanwhile, they're just laughing and laughing. And I go back to the camera for the second image, and I'll say, say hey, chicken.
Say chicken. Chicken! Hold your head right there.
And, you know, it's goofy. It doesn't make sense to adults, but it works wonderful.
Say, I'm cool.
I'm cool.
One more time, Mr. Cool. Last picture, okay? Then you can tell your mommy that you did a great job. Okay, you're done. Give yourself a hand.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye, kids.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Shay Shackelford. Silly Willy.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over 1 billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
Splishing and splashing bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, Big Bath. Big Bath is Wall Street's way of avoiding negative expectations by heaping on piles of bad news. Usually after a bad quarter, a company might report a decline in income that's worse than it really is. Since most investors are primed for it, they assume the worst must be over. This week, Bank of America and Citibank reported massive losses related to this summer's market mayhem, causing stocks to actually go up. But before anyone gets too happy, remember this. Hot water gets rid of dirt, but it can also burn.
Got a box full of letters. Think you might like to read.
All right. right, it is that time in the show where we talk about your questions, and with me is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. You ready for some questions?
Oh, absolutely. What are you going to hit me with this time?
Oh, you know, it's going to be a surprise for the next couple of minutes, because before we get to those questions, we're going to ask folks to take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button, or if you like, you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And Chris, our first caller of the day not only listens to the show, but is putting it to good use. Dan is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and the Red Sox are going to sweep, right?
I hope so.
All right, go Sox.
No, I'm sorry. They're not.
Oh, we have a Twins fan in the room.
I have to have a dissenting voice.
All right. All right, well, tell us a little bit about yourself, Dan. What do you do there in Beantown?
Well, I am Director of Student Financial Aid and Employment here at MIT in Cambridge. And as part of my role this year, I'm actually teaching a class for incoming freshmen. It's a class on personal finance. And one of the assignments our students have is actually listening to the Marketplace Money podcast.
All right. So we're on the syllabus for MIT.
You're on the syllabus. Absolutely.
I think I've hit my goal in life.
So the question I have for you is more of sort of a planning question. I'm interested to hear from you and Chris. What are the top recommendations you have for educating college freshmen about financial planning?
Well, that's a fantastic question. So let's start with the most important step for understanding personal finance when you head to college.
The most important thing to understand is debt. And it's not just that students are going to be taking on a lot of their student loans and understanding that student loan burden, but it's also the issue about credit cards. And Dan, you probably know the number better than I do, but what, it's 2/3 of graduating seniors have credit card debt?
Absolutely. It's continuing balances. So they're making small payments, and that's going to last them, if you will, a lifetime.
Yep, because that interest just keeps piling on.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of tricks to the trade. We've all fallen for it. You know, it's only $15 a month, you know, rather than looking at the total burden of the credit card debt. And that, to me, is one of the real keys, understanding the difference between good debt and bad debt, and understanding what are the student loan options. So that would be top of my list.
Dan, what do you find the freshmen actually know when they enter this class in terms of what debt is and how it works?
Very little. One of the first things we talked about was career planning, understanding that you shouldn't be borrowing more than you're going to be able to repay based on your starting salary.
So, Chris, obviously debt is the number one thing that these incoming freshmen need to hear and know about. What would be, say, the rest of the top five?
Well, one, and just echoing off what Dan has mentioned, you know, Tess, we talk a lot about fees and how important fees are. Well, one way of looking at expenses at college is, you know, 50% of your expense is tuition, but 50% is also the very expenses that you take on. So looking at those expenses and how do you cut those expenses, that's important.
Okay.
Investing. Every single one of these students, when they graduate or in a summer job, you know, they're going to face that 401k, that IRA issue. This is just the way the world has gone. And the final thing is a message. If you have some good personal finance habits, that's all we're talking about, not taking on credit card debt, saving for your retirement, saving for emergencies, investing in your career. If you have these good personal finance habits, you get two things that most people don't have. One, financial security, and two, the financial flexibility to take risks, to try something that if you're living on the financial edge, is simply too expensive to do.
So, Dan, how does any of that differ from perhaps what you already have on your syllabus?
That dovetails very nicely. The main difference, the thing that I'm also emphasizing, is that when you make a mistake, a financial mistake, it shouldn't be the end of your financial plan. Make sure there's a section in your financial plan that deals with the unexpected emergency.
Do you ask them to actually put together a financial plan before the end of the semester?
We do. The text we use actually has a financial planner built in, so they are building a financial plan as we go through the semester.
Well, I'll tell you what, your assignment is to send us some of those financial plans. We'd love to take a look at them and share them with our audience if your students would be willing.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Well, does that help you out?
It does. Thank you so much.
Okay, terrific. Say hi to your students for us.
Will do. Thanks.
Well, perhaps you're not getting the kind of education that could help your wallet. Let us tutor you to a better financial future. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that, speaking of MIT educations, M-O-N-Y.
You get a failing grade there. I'm sorry.
I know. Don't get me started. Well, folks, you asked for it. The epic battle between man and machine, the true test of a champion. It is time for the Mailbag Speed Round.
Oh, boy.
So this is the task. Answer five commonly asked questions here on the Marketplace Money Mailbag in less than 5 minutes. He's never been defeated. So with that, Chris, are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Cece from Los Angeles, California writes in. She has a new job, and she's making pretty good money to start out with, but she's got a $4,000 credit card bill and a partner who has $20,000 in student loans. She has about $10,000 saved in some stock accounts. So here's the common question we get. What do you do first? Should she use that to pay off her credit card or help her partner with her student debt?
All right. The student debt, your partner has a lot of flexibility. Let your partner handle the student debt. Now, I want you to do two things. First, let's look at that stock portfolio. Do you like these stocks? Maybe you want to keep them. That's one thing we want to look at. Evaluate the stock portfolio. Which stocks would you sell? Secondly, we want to attack that credit card debt. But you say you have a good paying job. So first, before you sell any stock, see how long would it take you to pay off the credit card debt off your new salary. So we have the new salary that will go to the credit card debt. My guess is you'll sell very little stock to pay down that credit card debt. As far as the student loan debt, leave it to your partner.
And leave the stock where it is?
And leave the stock where it is if you can. You might have to sell a little bit and pay capital gains. But let's first do that budget. Let's look at that new salary. And let's see if you can get rid of that credit card debt off your salary.
All right. Question number two. Pat from Fort Collins, Colorado. She is a single mother raising two kids on her own. By the time they're 14, she's going to be retired and probably eligible for Medicare. So here's her question. Will her children be covered by Medicare as well? Or will she have to buy separate health care coverage for them?
She'll have to buy separate health care coverage for them. Medicare will be for her, so that's good. What she can do is go to ehealthinsurance.com, and she can at least get a sense of what a policy will cost her by putting in some data, and she can buy a policy that will cover her children alone and at least get a sense what her out-of-pocket costs will be.
All right. We've got 3 minutes and 30 seconds to go. And Douglas writes in from, he's in your hood, St. Paul, Minnesota. And he's pretty established.
Oh, the hood. The hood.
The hood of St. Paul, Minnesota. Yeah. And he's pretty established in his career, but he's interested in doing some financial planning on the side. And he wants to become a certified fee-only planner. What's the best way to get started?
Well, you go to the website of the Certified Financial Planners. It's www.cfp.net, and you're going to complete a course. It's a board-registered education program. There's a couple requirements, and you have to have a bachelor's degree, and then you need to have 3 years of experience. But they lay it out very clearly what you need to do. It's going to take you several years to become a CFP, and then you do ongoing education. It's a good career. They are looking for people, and you can really find yourself a niche and help people out.
And I can definitely vouch for the fact that there's a market out there, because we get all kinds of questions from folks who want to hire a certified fee-only financial planner. All right. Question number four, and we are now almost 3 minutes into our five. Gary from Gardner, New York. He and his wife put investments into a custodial fund for their son to save on taxes when he was young. He's now a senior in high school. They want to put all that money back in their name. Can they make this switch, and what's the best way to do it?
No. You cannot make the switch.
All right. Thank you.
That's it. Okay. All right. I could go on. This is why I think people need to think about these custodial funds. But no, it is your child's money when he is of maturity.
Okay. Well, you know, we can actually take kind of a deep breath here because we're only 3.5 minutes into this. So I'm going to ask you this next question very slowly. Srini from Westboro, Massachusetts. Her mother-in-law lives in India and would like to make a gift to her son's 529 plan. Can she do that?
Absolutely. And it's one of the wonderful parts of a 529 plan. Now, this is, as everyone knows, this is the college savings plan. And what's really good about a 529 plan is that family, friends, relatives, the neighbor down the street, anybody can contribute to the 529 plan. So just because she lives in India has no implications. Obviously, you have to make the contribution in dollars. But I think it's wonderful. And we're coming on to holiday season, by the way. And it's one of those things that people can think about. Yes, you might want a gift of a toy for your child, but you could also say, rather than a toy, how about a contribution to the 529 plan?
All right, my friend. Well done. We are under 5 minutes.
Excellent.
Hope everyone enjoyed that. The mailbag speed round is now over. But if you've got a question that you think can't be answered in time, do give us a call. We'll try to help. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on that button that says Contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, caller number two is on the line. Helen is with us from the Emerald City, Seattle, Washington. Hello, Helen.
Hi.
What do you do there in the Emerald City?
I work for the university.
Oh, hey, go Fighting Huskies, right?
That's right.
All right, what do you do there?
I work in administration.
Okay, and what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I had a large royalty payment made to me this year.
What's the royalty for?
It's for some intellectual property that I was involved with.
Oh, okay.
If I had been putting money away into my Roth and then found out later that I did not qualify for a Roth, my income becomes larger than the cap. What happens to those funds?
Okay, so this is a question of you received a lump sum check, and that's going to boost your annual income for the year, and there are income limits on being able to put money into a Roth IRA. So what do you do if you have a year where you're not eligible? Chris?
Well, you get the money out before you file your taxes. That's the easiest thing.
How do you do that, Chris?
Just contact the financial institution that you have your Roth with and say you want to make a withdrawal of the money. They'll cut you a check. It's after-tax dollars by definition anyway. So all they're doing is sending you your contribution back for that year.
Okay.
If you end up filing your taxes, then there's another form that you need to fill out, and you have a certain 60 days, I believe it is, to fill out that form. But again, the idea is you get the money out of the Roth so that there's no implication going forward.
Chris, what happens if, you know, she's already got this Roth IRA open, and in previous years she was able to contribute to it. This is a year where she's not able to. The money can just sit there, right? And then perhaps next year, if she doesn't hit that income limit, she can contribute once again?
That's absolutely right. The account's open. It's continuing to compound. It's continuing to grow. You don't make a contribution for 2007. But in 2008, if your income changes, then you make the contribution and everything goes forward. So you don't have to close the Roth. You don't have to do anything. You just leave it alone and let it compound. And then later on, once your income drops below the limits, you make the full contribution.
All right. Well, so does that help you out?
Yeah, I appreciate that advice.
Well, thanks so much for the call.
Oh, thank you.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Well, Chris, unfortunately, we're done.
Is that it? We got to do this next week, you know?
We will. And if you've got questions that we can take on next week's show, leave them on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or visit our contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, you think it's hard finding a real-life person on the other end of a customer service telephone call? Imagine if you went online and tried to get some help.
Cannot improvise, cannot answer questions, and after a while, the novelty wears off.
Yeah, and virtual salespeople don't get benefits either, I'm guessing. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. So there's this clothing retailer. I love their jeans and T-shirts. Good fit, decent prices. I used to go into their stores all the time until I got sick of being accosted every 2 minutes with a different salesperson chirping, "Can I help you find something?" It got so bad, I started ordering everything online. But I still may not be safe. Internet businesses are trying anything and everything to market to their customers. The latest method? Virtual salespeople. Chicago Public Radio's Mike Rhee reports.
Avatars are nothing new. The word actually comes from Sanskrit. It's for a deity that's taken on a human form. But in the world of the internet, avatars are humans who've taken on a digital form. People have been using avatars for years to represent themselves on the web. Now companies are starting to catch on.
Bonjour, I am Mon Ami Zoe.
That's an avatar for a coffee website called Les Beans Coffee. Patty Lucia is the co-owner and says the characters she creates represent the different blends of coffee her company sells.
Mostly it adds personality to the website, and I think that people can connect to that.
Lucia says the characters keep her website fresh. She gives each character a special touch and even thinks up their origins and backstories.
We really wanted to create sexy, quirky, smart, powerful women characters. So, you know, you can choose eye color and the size of the nose and their jewelry or their sunglasses and things like that.
This is marketing in a different level, but it's the same principles.
Leo Arakliotis teaches computer science at the University of Chicago. He says avatar salespeople cater to basic human needs, just like regular salespeople. So interactivity, politeness, even sex appeal can play a factor in how effective avatars can be. Arakliotis says younger people who are used to video games and computer-animated movies are especially primed for online salespeople.
Rather than reading a paragraph or two on a computer screen or on a brochure, they may want to hear it from a talking head on their computer.
Meantime, Arakliotis says it'll be a while before avatars can compete with the real thing.
The avatar cannot improvise, cannot answer questions, and after a while, the novelty wears off.
Some market research shows avatars can help sales, but the data's limited. Still, bigger companies have taken notice. Kraft Foods recently dipped its toe in some virtual waters by promoting its products in the online community Second Life. In Second Life, avatars walk around the virtual world and do everyday things, meet friends, go dancing, or shop. Kraft has put its products in a virtual grocery store. There's even samples, except you can't really taste them. Lisa Gibbons, a Kraft spokesperson, says Kraft is working on letting the avatars give consumers visual cues about how things taste.
Maybe say you taste a slice of pizza and it's spicy, that maybe it'll, you know, have a little hot pepper that flashes up, or another way to kind of cue the consumer on what that really tastes like.
Only time will tell if consumers bite. In Chicago, I'm Mike Rhee for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Union employees at General Motors are now voting on the deal that got them back to work after a 2-day strike. Some 16,000 union jobs could end up with less pay and no retiree health care. At one time, these jobs helped build the middle class, but now they might fill the ranks of another class. Catherine Newman is co-author of a new book titled The Missing Class. And Catherine, who fits into this new category? How do you define missing class?
They really are the group that's up above the poverty line and still struggling. And there are lots of them. There are over 50 million of them, while we have about 34 million poor families in the United States.
What are some other characteristics of the missing class, aside from whether they are above or below the poverty line?
Well, they're definitely above the poverty line, but they also hold the kinds of service occupations that do not pay exceptionally well, but are pretty fundamental to the American economy. So they work in jobs like orderlies in our hospitals, or working as teacher's aides. And very often, in order to be in the missing class, it requires more than one of these jobs. But I don't want to paint a portrait of them as totally disastrous and plagued with social problems. They actually see themselves as relatively fortunate compared to the lives they led if they were down below the poverty line before. And many of them are success stories of upward mobility, just not very far up and not necessarily very securely in that station.
Can you give us an example, perhaps one of the examples in your book, you know, that are essentially case studies?
Absolutely. So let me choose, for example, Tomas Linares, who is of Puerto Rican origin. He grew up in a very poor household, came to the United States when he was a young man, and had a kind of tough life in his teenage years, lived in a pretty rough neighborhood, got into some trouble when he was a young man, but straightened himself out, had a family. He works two jobs, more or less 7 days a week. And between those two jobs, Tomas earns a little bit more than $20,000 a year. So he's actually very securely in the missing class, because technically there's only a family size of one in his household. But a lot of people depend on him. His two daughters depend on him. His mother expects to see him every day, and she needs his financial help. A more fortunate case would be Julia Coronado, who actually started off in the Dominican Republic, ended up working in a factory. She didn't speak English at the time. She got a decent degree from a junior college and finally landed what has become her dream job. She works in a doctor's office, and her cleverness allowed her to produce a new system for scheduling these doctor's patients. Hence, she has become a very valuable node in that office. She now earns about $32,000 a year. She has a family of four to take care of. But she also has higher expectations for her material life. She is more of a consumer than she used to be. She works a lot, so she would really like to have some creature comforts to show for it. And that tends to push her in the direction of credit cards she should never use. So these are just a couple of examples of missing class families here in the New York area.
How do they perceive themselves in terms of where they fall on the scale? You know, this is a new concept of the missing class.
They do distinguish themselves from those who are below them, and they know lots of people who are poor. But they also recognize that unless they're able to get a lot more education and move higher up the scale than they are, they're never going to be completely secure or comfortable.
Yeah, well, and they're just barely ineligible for things like, you know, tax credits and social services like welfare, right?
That's exactly right. They really earn too much money in the way we define eligibility for these programs to get health care that comes to the poor, for example. So they really are caught in between, and there isn't any public policy that's directed at them. But that leaves, as I said, you know, over 50 million people who are in this group that for whom we really don't have any answers in terms of their long-range economic security or the mobility of their children.
Well, you say we don't really have any answers, but let me ask you if in your research, you've come up with some potential solutions.
One suggestion I would have is that we think hard about making low-income home ownership a more realistic possibility. If we had a better system of universal early childhood education, we would see the inequalities between families leveled to a degree that would help the children in these families do better in school, even if their parents can't help them, either because they lack the skills or because they lack the time.
Well, you know, this all sounds awfully intractable. You're asking for a lot. What happens if none of this comes to fruition?
Well, it is asking for a lot. Let me answer your first point. But it costs us a lot not to do these things. These things are not impossible. They are costly, but there are huge benefits, and I don't just mean social justice benefits. I mean bottom line benefits to this kind of investment. And of course, we've done it before. It cost a lot to create the Social Security system. It cost a lot to mount the GI Bill, but we built a modern middle class out of it. So sometimes those investments pay off in a more prosperous nation.
Catherine Newman is co-author of The Missing Class. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, as you know, we have a weekly mailbag to answer your burning financial questions. Well, every month we also have a letters segment for your comments about the show. So here we go. Howard Feingold contacted us from North Chatham, New York, and he's having trouble tracking down the story we promoted at the top of last week's show. Your setup piece on $34 coffee intrigued me, he writes, but I did not hear the answer you said would follow during the show. I have become addicted to your fine program and like it as much as my morning caffeine fix. Now, there's a compliment to wake up to. Well, the answer was not that Starbucks is selling what we dubbed the Stockachino, a cup of coffee and a share in the company. The story we referenced was about overdraft fees. If you're not paying attention to your balance, a $2 cup of coffee can end up costing you $34 in fees. That's a buzz you don't want. Confused by our inside quote? Maybe it's time for a change. Write us and tell us what you want to hear at the top of the show. Fritz Seegers of Kalamazoo, Michigan, took exception to our feature about receiving early Social Security payments. We asked, what if you outlive your benefits? Mr. Seegers has other concerns.
Why wait when we can take the money earlier, when we're bound to be far more active? Secondly, there are literally thousands of us who have had dead-end jobs or are forced out due to our age. I think your piece was perfect for a person who loves his or her job and can easily wait for full retirement age, a luxury that few of us have these days.
And we got lots of kudos for the trash challenge. I carried my trash around for 2 weeks to see if I could get it down to zero. A lot of that involved recycling every bit of paper and plastic I used. Katrina Rideout of Arlington, Massachusetts, says there's more to do. She works for a company that helps schools, hospitals, and other organizations with their recycling efforts.
When you do think about recycling, you probably think of what I call the usual suspects: bottles and cans,
and paper. These are great things to recycle, but there's so much more out there if only you think creatively and speak up. There's old furniture, computers, and even construction waste.
I'll be sure to share that with the painters at my house this week. We love to get your comments, compliments, and even your complaints. What do you think of the show? What are we not covering that you think we should? Write to us. Go to marketplace.org and click on the button that says Contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, socially responsible investing is hot, hot, hot these days.
And I blame you, Tess.
Oh,
I blame you for this.
Okay.
Carrying that trash around. I mean, one of the reasons why there's all this interest in social responsible investing is sustainability, global warming, all these kind of concerns.
Right.
But I want to focus on a truly controversial aspect of social responsible investing. And what I'm calling it is a tale of two revolutions.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
You got it. Let's start with the worst, the Saffron Revolution in Burma. It's just horrific watching that nation stomp on a monk-led rebellion. So the global investment mantra is boycott Burma.
Right.
But Tess, then there's the latest twist in Ukraine's Orange Revolution. That country just had a peaceful election. Now, it still has big problems, corruption, for example, but it's looking more like a democracy than before. How should a socially responsible investor look at the Ukraine, which, by the way, has the world's second best performing stock market so far this year? Here's a straight story. Sometimes a boycott is the right thing to do, but more often the real trick in making the world a better place is investing in frontier markets, even at the cost of some virtue.
All right. Well, when you talk about frontier markets, is that essentially the same as emerging markets?
These are not the China, India, Brazil, Russia, sort of the big four of the emerging markets. This is the sort of the next level that are trying to emulate those four giants.
Well, of course, the ongoing debate over investing in these types of markets in these types of countries is, do you invest and hope that the rise of capitalism and that an influx of money is going to help change things? Or do you boycott and say, look, we're not giving you anything unless you do change? So how do you balance those two when you're making your investment choice?
I think it's really tough. When you have a situation like Burma or a situation like Darfur, it's a relatively simple choice for most of us. We don't want our money to be there. But once you get outside of that level, then it becomes more complicated and it really becomes a big debate and it comes to the core, the heart of socially responsible investing. Do you invest in countries like China or in go to the Ukraine, which has genuine corruption? But markets are more open. You have engagement. And I'd always like to throw in the one counterexample that to me is extremely powerful, Cuba. What if we had traded with Cuba rather than had an embargo and a boycott with Cuba? My guess is that our relations with that nation and that nation, it would be vastly different than it is today. So I'm a skeptic about boycotts, except for the extreme. And right now, we are living in the midst of one of them, and I would call that Burma.
Well, you mentioned China, and you know the argument there was that Western investment would help liberalize the country.
Right.
But you know, then you have some companies that go in there and basically kowtow to all kinds of questionable things. You know, Google helping the Chinese government limit citizens' access to the web, for instance. Google says, well, we're in their country. We have to play by their rules. How is that making the world a better place?
Well, in my value system, it is bringing China into the world trade system. Yes, there are violations. It's uncomfortable. We hold our nose. Nevertheless, the internet has continued to spread in China. Information barriers that the Communist Party has set up are breaking down. And you have a lot of trading going on. And trading is the enemy of secrecy. It is the enemy of the bureaucracy. Over time, we really don't have any better idea than trade liberalization when it comes to dealing with dictatorships and countries that we're really uncomfortable with. It is the flow of information that, in the end, bureaucracies can't contain.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, I guess sometimes you just got to pick the lesser of two evils, huh?
He actually said it better than I did. Thanks.
And finally this week, some HD DVD movies now have a new feature. You can go online right from your video player and buy products related to the film. Fans of the Noah's Ark comedy Evan Almighty, for instance, can buy rain barrels. Now, it seems to us it'd be quite inappropriate to use certain movies to market stuff, but the marketplace players bet Hollywood will give it a try.
Welcome to Oliver Stone's HD DVD showroom. Now you can bring a little piece of Oliver's magical movie world into your very own home.
Greed is good. Greed is right.
Sure is. So let's buy some stuff. Do you dig Richard Nixon? Oliver Stone doesn't, but he did make a film about America's shamed president, and now we're proud to offer the official Nixon reel-to-reel paranoid surveillance recorder. Secretly tape friends, family, and political enemies. Comes with free Zippo, so you can burn the tapes like Nixon didn't.
Come on, give me some death!
Sorry, Jim Morrison, we don't carry death. But fans of Oliver's film, The Doors, can enjoy the next best thing, a 27-year supply of whiskey, just like Jim drank. Chug a few bottles a day and wham, you're the Lizard King. You can do anything, including dying young. It's just a remote click away in our showroom. Still not satisfied? That's because you don't own a Born on the 4th of July threadbare military jacket. At last, you can sport the style of an embittered warrior abandoned by his government.
People say if you don't love America, then get the hell out. Well, I love America.
And America loves stuff. So don't think about the movie. Start shopping.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, our own Rico Galliano gets educated about Roth IRAs. Hey, Rico, pretty simple, right?
Making rice is simple. Personal finance is not simple.
Okay. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.